effective field theories. We start off with some effective theory which has a high energy cutoff and lots of energy levels, and we scale them out and we get another one with, in this case, only two levels, and we go to a new effective Hamiltonian. And in the space of possible parameters, we hope that we'll get to a fixed point or a fixed line. Curiously, this is mathematically improbable. We don't normally expect with nonlinear equations of this kind to do that, but it's what's supposed to happen. To look at it in a slightly different way, and I'm showing you some real systems here, helium superfluid crystal, and this is supposed to be a string sheet. We start off with some larger Hilbert space, and we're supposed to go to a smaller one. And it was maintained the other day that the smaller one was entirely contained in the larger one. In fact, this picture is misleading because that's often not the case. But in any case, the idea is that we go down in energies, we're approaching some real vacuum, which is associated with the real physical system. And I think that, you know, this sort of general idea is widely believed. Certainly the idea that all Hamiltonians in theoretical physics are effective ones, I think, is understood except in undergraduate textbooks. But it's not the only way of looking at things. This is another caricature of the same thing. We're flowing between various, often voiding, there are often repulsive fixed points here. This is what I would call a Phil Anderson view of things, at least at one time. But there are other ideas. So to provoke a bit of discussion, I'll show you another one which starts from the bottom and goes up. This is the idea of the quantum critical point. And the idea is that the physics at higher energies is determined by the critical point at zero energy here. This is actually the phase diagram drawn by John Hertz in 1970 for the quantum icing model. So this is the coupling constant, this is the temperature, and this critical point arrives when the coupling between the spins is of the same order as the transverse field in the system. And the idea is you pass between two phases at zero temperature, and that somehow the physics up here is controlled by this point. And some have even maintained, for example, Preskill at one time, that you could have a theory of everything starting from these quantum critical points, that everything up here would be determined by this point. So I'd like to provide some reality checks here in both cases. In this one, I'm going to talk more about this. The reality check is that any complex system, and I'm going to discuss this in more detail, is not going to have just a few of these. This waterfall is going to go on forever. That in fact, we'll find that the cascade continues ad infinitum in the thermodynamic limit. We'll see that. And I guess the reality check here is that I think it's pretty unlikely that the physics of all of the excited states is going to be determined by the ground state. It may be the case in some very, very specialized models, but they're certainly not generic. So I'd like to fill out what I said, and this is necessarily a quick talk, by discussing some examples. And I've always liked this little quote. I'm going to use a few quotes here from great sages. So this one here is actually an exhortation more to the philosophers than the physicists to fill out general discussions with examples. So here's an example, which I'm sure that somebody like Shankar or Bhaskaran will be very familiar with and will have lots of opinions about, so I'm going to tell you my opinion. This is the standard model of condensed matter physics, at least according to many. It's called the Hubbard model. It says that you have some set of sites. They don't have to be on a lattice, but you can pick them to be on one, and let's do so to make it simple. And the Hamiltonian simply says that if you have two fermions on the same site, and they necessarily have to have opposite spin to be on the same site, then there will be a repulsion between them. But there's also a so-called hopping term, which allows them to hop between sites. Actually, the need for such a Hamiltonian was first articulated by Piles in 1937, which is why it's called the Hubbard model. Now, let's imagine two cases of this Hamiltonian. On the one hand, I'm going to say that U is really small. In other words, the repulsion is small. Everything is in the kinetic energy. The particles are zipping around between sites. and there's only a weak repulsion between them. Then we like to draw the following picture. This is a sight picture. This shows you, for example, what happens if each sight happens to be occupied by two electrons. Then we have two bands separated by an energy roughly U, and there are two N electrons in the lower band, where N is the number of sights. If I take one electron out, then I simply remove a state from this lower band. I hope you can all see there's a little area there, and it's gone. If I add one, well, it has to go to a higher energy level because all of the sites, the low energy sites are occupied, the low energy levels are occupied, and that's why it goes to this upper band. And this is what we call the semiconductor picture, and it's the one you see in all of the undergraduate, a lot of the graduate textbooks in solid state physics. However, let's now imagine that U is big. In other words, it's not the kinetic energy that's dominating, but the potential energy. That it costs an awful lot to put two electrons on the same site. Here it doesn't cost very much, so they're happy to do it. But here it does. Now let's see what happens. We start off now with one electron per site. And we ask, what happens if we take one away? I'm going to remove one here. Well, here's the surprise. In the limit where U is much bigger than T, there are now two empty states in this lower band, not one. Why? Well, I could fill this up with either an up or a down spin. But you say, well, what's happened? Well, the interesting thing that's happened is that one of the empty states has popped down from the high energy to the low energy. This is called spectral weight transfer. If I do the opposite, if I now add an extra electron where I previously had n, so I have to have two electrons on one site now, well, that extra electron obviously has to be at high energy. But there are two states up here and only n minus one down here. Why? Well, there are n minus one low energy states because I've got n minus one different choices for adding a particle to produce a high energy state. Now, what is the reason? Why is this important? You might say, well, this is just playing around with dominoes. But the interesting thing is here is to ask the following question. Supposing I would like to construct an effective low energy Hamiltonian for this system, which is what we're all supposed to believe we can do. This would involve having some effective Hamiltonian concentrated around the Fermi energy. And this, you know, this is what you're supposed to be able to do all the time. But it's a problem because supposing I now ask, okay, fine, I've got an effective Hamiltonian concentrated around the Fermi energy, but if it's a meaningful Hamiltonian, I should be able to take particles in and out. I should be able to add them, take them away. There should be effective operators that do that. But the problem is every time I do that, states pop in and out of my Hilbert space. And they're popping out from high energies. In string theory, this is called ultraviolet infrared mixing. In condensed matter theory, we just call it spectral weight transfer. But it's a problem, because it means that you can't define the low energy effect of theory independently of the high energy excitations. So this is my first conundrum. Here's another one. Let's imagine we have the solid that I told you about, the Hubbard model, is one that's used by, you know, a very large number of condensed matter physicists who like to think that, you know, lattices describe everything, but as you probably noticed, if you didn't notice from Nigel's talk, you'll notice by looking around you, there are almost no lattices in this room. Most of the solid world, at any rate, is described by disorder systems. And I'm not going to go through the long discussion which leads us to arrive at an effective Hamiltonian for a dielectric insulator. And somebody said yesterday that insulators were boring. I believe it was Shankar. You're an insulator, you know. In this insulator, let's call it the Shankar Hamiltonian, we have a whole bunch of two-level systems. And these two-level systems interact with each other. These sigmas are Pauli matrices. But they also have local fields on each other. Now, these two-level systems need not be spins. They could be electric dipoles. I mean, there are many different things they can be. But the key about this is that these interactions tend to be long-range. In fact, it's almost impossible to get rid of dipolar interactions. And what you find under those circumstances is that there is a hierarchy of states, and this is a picture here, I think it was drawn by Phil Anderson, showing this hierarchy of states. This is the so-called ultrametric picture of a disordered system. The idea here is that it looks like a taxonomy, but the idea is that this just goes on and on. And so if you are at low energies and you want to get to some other low energy state, you have to climb up through a large number of other states and go back down again. In other words, you have to rearrange the system very badly, which means that, in fact, I mean, there's an exponential of some power of n number of states down here, and to go between them takes a time of that order, which, and it's rather like Bill's discussion, it really makes no difference whatsoever what the prefactor is. We're talking about, for all practical purposes, infinity. So we have an infinite hierarchy of states, an infinite hierarchy of relaxation times, most of which are very, very long indeed, and an infinite hierarchy of effective Hamiltonians, because as you go down here, the effective Hamiltonian keeps on changing. And in fact, you can see this very easily in experiments. This shows experiments on essentially the capacitance as a function of electric field of, I think this was just some ordinary material like epoxy. No, sorry, it's mylar. And the difference between these pictures is the temperature. These are experiments done by Doug Oshroff. Now look at this lowest temperature, it's 2.5 millikelvin. That's, you know, five orders of magnitude lower temperature than this room. People have gone lower this. The interesting thing is that this is actually telling you about the effect of Hamiltonian, the density of states. It's changing with temperature, and it keeps on changing, no matter how low temperature you go to. In other words, the effect of Hamiltonian never stops changing. So that's our second conundrum, and it's actually about real systems. And I'm not going to talk about this. Different people have tried to understand this, including us, and I would say to not much effect. And I simply didn't have time to write my summary, but the picture, I think, says it all. Wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels. And there is some quote by Feynman to that effect, that maybe that's all nature really is. Okay, so now, what about my main topic? Yes, sir. Yes, that you know, people who think that they can tell us about the real world by referring to Fermi liquids and BCS superconductors are just dreaming. And I think the one person that has driven this point home more than anyone else in the last 40 years has been Anderson, who's pointed out that you simply cannot embrace the whole of the condensed matter world by talking about these very limited examples, whose realization boils down to, say, aluminium and helium-3. Or helium-4, if you want a Bose system. So what about decoherence? For non-North Americans here, 100 means it's the introductory course. So this is the introduction to decoherence. And I actually suspect that almost everybody here knows exactly what I'm talking about. We have a system, some particle, say, going through two slits. We end up with a superposition of states coming from the two paths here. But if we couple this to an environment, let's say photons, which have in states, and we'll label the photons by Q, then of course the final state now involves superpositions of particle plus photons. But now if we then average over the photon states, arguing that we don't know them, if we trace them out, then we're left with a loss of interference. And this process is called decoherence. All I want to do is note two things here. First of all, there's no requirement for energy to be exchanged here. And in fact, we'll see that in many cases, there is very little energy exchanged, or even none, in decoherence processes. That means there's only an exchange of phase information. And that means that there's no necessity for dissipation in decoherence. So there's a long argument, about 10 years ago about whether or not decoherence and dissipation were necessarily related. And unfortunately, one of the models that was used involved such a connection, but it generically is not the case. That is to say that the destruction of the phase interference between the two paths, it doesn't necessarily have to be associated even with the noise coming from the environment, and certainly not dissipation. These messages are important for what's going to follow. Now, people do use effective Hamiltonians to describe decoherence, and there are essentially two classes of them. at the moment. One involves a central system being coupled to a set of oscillators. This model was, I mean, of course, it goes back to the beginning of, well, it goes back to Rayleigh, I guess. But it was really pushed by Feynman and Vernon, later by Calder and Leggett and so on. And the key point here is you've got some system described by H0 and an interaction and an environment. The environment is a set of oscillators with different frequencies. And the coupling here is linear in the oscillator degrees of freedom. Why? Because it's supposed to be weak. And it's supposed to be weak because there is an awful lot of oscillators. And each one of them is only affected weakly by the central system. And in fact, this is the coupling is of order 1 over root n, and that's what allows you to define a thermodynamic limit for this, because all of the effects of the oscillators are going like coupling constant squared. So n times 1 over root n squared equals 1, is independent of n. Okay, but in fact, this model only describes delocalized environmental modes. The problem is that the environment will contain defects, dislocations, vibrons, localized electrons, spin impurities, nuclear spins, and so on and so on, which, in fact, at low temperatures are what dominate in the environment. I have a nice picture which shows that, but no time. And again, the environment now is, guess what? A set of two-level systems, or it could be three or four-level, depends. I mean, nuclear spins could have 2i plus 1 levels, with interactions which happen to be long-range and frustrating between them. Plus an interaction here. Now, this interaction may not be small, but I just want to point out that this Hamiltonian for the environment here is exactly the same one as I was speaking about a few minutes ago, the one which leads to an infinite hierarchy of Hamiltonians. Anyone who's ever looked at NMR knows that the solution of the dynamics of this is a very interesting problem. So, there, in other words, there's another kind of environment which is composed of localized modes which don't look like oscillators at all and which don't necessarily couple weakly to the central system. And I would say that the most important advance in experimental studies of decoherence in the last decade or so has been the realization that in pretty much any condensed matter system, it's the spin bath here, we call it, that dominates the decoherence at low temperatures. Forget about this, haven't got time. So now let's go back to the real world again. So I want to show you an example of what I'm talking about so you can see what it all means. And another quote here. So the example I'm going to tell you about is interesting because the first experiments, for example, on decoherence in superconducting systems found a decoherence rate that was 6 orders of magnitude higher than the theory predicted. The theory was an oscillator bath theory of the theory of Calder and Leggett. The experiments were actually first done in Delft. And the difference was, you know, staggering. The prediction was a decoherence time of 12 milliseconds, and the measured decoherence time was 1 nanosecond. Why? Well, it was very simple. The superconductor was full of defects, and these were causing all the decoherence. But they almost caused almost no dissipation. This has now been proved without any doubt in experiments done, for example, in Santa Barbara and in NIST. So what we wanted to do is find a system where you could actually predict the decoherence rate and get it right, okay, for a complex system. Well,
what states of the defects are being occupied in this decohering process?
Okay, so you have to know what the defects are first. So in the superconductors, those defects are the two-level systems are basically very small motions of atoms between two states which have similar energy, and it's a tunneling process. And the defects are, the fields acting on them are strain fields in the system, so that's, if you like, the H sub K that I wrote down. And then there's a tunneling amplitude, which is just a tunneling amplitude between the sites. These defects may be vacancies, they may be interstitials. In a typical solid, there's a whole variety of different kind of lattice defects that you can have. For example, they may be defects on a dislocation. Okay. In this system, we'll find that the spin bath, the defects are actually nuclear spins, and that they can make the system well enough so that there aren't any lattice defects to speak of. The reason they can do that is because these things are made by nature, not by man. That is, quantum chemistry makes these things, and they're all the same, provided the chemists don't really mess up. So I discovered some time ago that the literature on these high-spin molecules exceeds in number, that is the number of papers, exceeds the total number of papers in high-temperature superconductivity by a factor of 3, which tells you something about chemists. We're going to focus on one of these. So this is a molecule which has spin 10. The underlying transition metal spins are all locked together into what we call a giant spin. And I'm not going to discuss the tunneling dynamics, which is fascinating. It involves Berry phases and so forth. I'm simply going to tell you about a recent experiment. So a crystal of these things was made. This shows the picture. And then you can ask, well, how am I supposed to describe such a system? And the answer is, it's a mess, because we've got the two-level systems, which correspond to these big spins tunneling between up and down. So that's a set of two-level systems. We've got dipolar interactions between them, magnetic dipolar interactions, which are, again, long-range and frustrating. And then they interact with nuclear spins, with phonons, and so on. So it's a mess. It's also, if you like, the standard model for a quantum computer. Because if you want to make a quantum computer, you have a set of qubits which interact with each other, and it's basically impossible to get rid of dipolar interactions. And you attempt to control them by changing the fields on them. So I'm not going to go through the details because there's no time, but basically the predictions of the dynamics of this focused on the 213 different nuclear spins in the system, for which all of the couplings to the central qubit were known, the phonons, which were also understood, and the long-range interactions coming from the long-range dipolar interactions between all of these qubits. And the prediction was that you would get a coherent dynamics of all of these qubits in a region of the sample, which is shown here for one particular external field. You could vary the external field and vary the region of the sample in which this happens. So you have to imagine a coherent collective motion of all these qubits together in this region of the sample. And so the experimenters did this, and then they did spin echo experiments, which picked out that region of the sample and essentially tried to make all of the qubits together behave coherently. And what they were trying to do was measure T2, I'm not going to discuss this, and see if it agreed with the theory. And what happened was these guys in Santa Barbara phoned us up and said, look, we've done this experiment. It's actually not the same configuration as your theoretical prediction of 2006. Here's the configuration we actually have. We have two different samples of the following shape with two different field orientations. Will you please calculate what we should get? But they refused to tell us what they'd got. So I said, fine. And Igor Tupitsin at UBC, he actually plugged it all into a computer, put the shape of the sample in the computer, the fields and all that, and popped it out. And that were these lines for different samples, and this is the data. We were pretty pleased by that, particularly as the maximum Q factor, that is the inverse of the decoherence time divided by the operating time of the qubit, essentially the number of times it rings before decoherence set in, the maximum decoherence Q in the experiment was 1.5 times 10 to the 6. The theoretical limit, they couldn't get to low temperatures, was 6 times 10 to the 8, which for anybody working in this field is very, very good indeed. It's far higher than even optical qubit systems. So we thought that was kind of nice. And then I was going to write my conclusions, but I woke up too late. My conclusion here is that all of this sounds very nice. This is actually the first time theoretical predictions of decoherence rates on a solid-state system have actually agreed with experiment. But we know it's all going to go wrong at lower temperatures because the effect of Hamiltonian is going to change again. What's going to happen is that correlations will start to be set up between the spins and the nuclear spins in the bath. And then everything that I've just said is wrong, or rather has to be redone. And in fact, we'll have to redo it over and over again as we go to lower and lower temperatures, ad infinitum. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about, which is probably more interest to many people here, is what I call intrinsic decoherence. And I'm not going to talk about this third-party stuff, which is something that Bill and I have been discussing for some years. For the philosophers amongst you, this is actually published in a philosophy journal. And so what I'm going to talk about is a case, 5 minutes, a case where the decoherence is not arising because we've got some environment whose effects we're averaging over to get decoherence in some restricted system. The argument here is that this is intrinsic, that it's something you can't get rid of, it's part of nature. The first suggestion that I had to come to grips with of this kind was one proposed by Tolft. He did it when I was actually in Utrecht. We ran the same institute. And it's a rather peculiar idea, which I'm sure some people have opinions on here, the idea that the total amount of information in the universe is constrained by the number of surface states. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about something a little more specific, which is the idea proposed a long time ago by Diossi and reprised by Penrose and discussed to the point where he, along with Baumeister, who's an experimentalist working in both Santa Barbara and Leiden, actually proposed an experiment. And that starts to make it interesting to somebody like me. So the idea is the following, and I'm putting this in language quite different from Penrose. Let's imagine we have a system propagating from 1 to 2. And according to quantum mechanics in the form given by Feynman, we can imagine it following a whole bunch of different paths. And we're supposed to add up the contribution of each of these paths independently to get an amplitude to propagate between 1 and 2. Essentially what Penrose, Diossi, and also other people proposing, if you like, intrinsic ideas, for example, the Girardi et al., what they're proposing is that this is not correct anymore, that somehow these paths are not independent, that there's a correlation between them. And we would like to understand that. Now, Penrose does not give a theory for this. He simply says that, he gives essentially a dimensional argument. He says, well, you know, if I imagine two different states of a massive body, then the proper time that one calculates in the two different states will be very slightly different because of the gravitational self-interaction between these things. And he then argues that that gravitational self-interaction, which he writes in this classical Newtonian form, as the interaction between the density distributions in the two states, corresponds to an energy uncertainty and therefore to a time which is going to be observable in an experiment as an effect of decoherence. In other words, somehow the states involved will decohere with each other over that time scale. Baumeister is building a very interesting experiment, which I hope will yield results soon, to test this. The masses involved are actually mesoscopic vibrators, which can be put in coherent superpositions of states with slightly different positions. I'm not going to go into the details. They're between the same object in different states. So this is the density distribution for state I, and this is the density distribution for state J. Okay? So you see, this is path I, and this is path J, and this is the interaction between them. Okay, so I didn't have time to type all this out, so this is actually going to be appearing in a special issue of Phil Tran's Roy Sock A on decoherence. But I just want to give you a flavor for the sort of thing that one can discuss here. We know that in ordinary quantum mechanics, we write down a path integral which sums over all of these paths. Now let's introduce a new rule in quantum mechanics. Let's supposing that we can add something to this, which seems to have been cut off. We add a delta G to this, and this delta G involves a correlation between the paths. We haven't said what this correlator is. What I can tell you immediately is what it is in Penrose's theory. In other words, we can actually formalize Penrose's argument by saying that the correlator has this form in his theory, in this Newtonian approximation. And you see there's this interaction between the paths which diverges as the paths approach each other, which is a problem. Or at least I think it's a problem. So this delta G can then be written in this form, and actually one can calculate this. And guess what? It diverges. So Penrose, I'll just say that a little more. So to regularize this calculation, we do what has to happen in the experiment. We imagine that the object is in some potential, which I'm going to take to be some very weak parabolic potential, and we can actually calculate this by separating variables and so on and so on, and we get a horrible divergence. The answer is infinite. So the problem here is that we're trying to mix together a gravitational interaction which diverges as things approach each other with a quantum mechanical formalism. And this is not this calculation is non-relativistic. One could try arguing that by doing the thing properly, this would go away, but I think we know that that's not going to happen. So this is a problem. Another problem is that this kernel is not actually causing decoherence in the traditional sense, but actually it's just causing a phase shift, geometric phase shifts. So I just want to finish by noticing that this phase shift in such theories is very interesting. I guess I haven't got time to discuss the details, but the final answer for it is that you get a sum over... how much time do I have left? 1 minute. You know what? I think I'm not going to discuss that. It'll take 5 minutes to explain it. So what have we learned? Oh, it actually works. Okay, this is wheels within wheels within wheels, and the animation is actually working. I'm quite pleased with that. Okay, so I think one thing we've learned is that, in the first part of this talk, is that at least if you're a condensed matter physicist, there's rather a lot of evidence that nature is indeed wheels within wheels within wheels. The problem in particle physics is that the distance between the successive energy scales is enormous and costs a hell of a lot of money to get to or to bridge, whereas we could actually do it rather cheaply, at least if we have low temperature labs. So I would say that, I think the onus is on the people who are proposing the theory of everything to really tell us why these wheels stop. And then, as Dirac says in his book, what are they made of? The fundamental wheels. So that's the first thing that I would like to note in passing.
Back to Maxwell.
You think this is Maxwell?
Of
course, yes, right, absolutely, yeah. Okay, the second thing is that when you're dealing with decoherence, you have an extra problem, which is that you need, if I'd had time to talk about third-party decoherence, this would have been a little more obvious. When you're talking about the effect of Hamiltonian of one system, you can say, okay, it's isolated. That's fine. But when you're talking about decoherence, you have to worry about what it might have correlated with at any previous time, even if that system has gone away. So, in other words, if you're going to write down an effect of Hamiltonian which is capable of dealing with decoherence, it has to include not only the system that you're dealing with, but also everything that it might have dealt with, and not necessarily by exchanging energy, but only phase, or by somehow being set up so that its state was correlated with that of another state, a so-called state preparation, the phrase of Marginal from 1931. In other words, writing down effective Hamiltonians to deal with decoherence is even worse than it is for ordinary systems, dealing with ordinary problems. And then finally, I guess what I've learned is I wanted to ask the philosophers what we've learned, because for the life of me, I guess I follow Shankar here, it's not actually clear to me what the deep philosophical problems are in this discussion. There are a lot of interesting problems in physics, but I've yet to be convinced that at the moment we're dealing with problems that are philosophically deep. Okay, thank you.
Due to time constraints, I'm going to ask you to hold your fire until the general discussion after the morning session. Thank you again.
Right.